here on 90.1 FM KPFT, Houston's community station.
This is 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 Houston, with translators at 89.5 FM K208DG Galveston and 91.9 FM K220KC Huntsville. Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT, a Pacifica radio station.
Hey, it is 5 p.m. Thursday, time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and you're going to find it only on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored KPFT. I am Hank Rubicek, producer and tonight's host, and alongside the best team on radio, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers whose stories take us on journeys through windows of their souls, before returning safely to the present. You know, renowned storyteller Joel Ben Izzy is a person I'm proud to call a friend. Eric Heen and I hosted him on this show a couple of times, and he was nothing short of mesmerizing. During one program, Joel guided us through an exercise called going to the well, a technique constructed by his wife and coined by him. It's simple, really. You resurrect a memorable moment, complete with all the sensory stimuli that accompanies it, recall it chronologically, remain focused and descriptive, and you have a story. Well, it's a highly effective method for crafting a personal narrative, but like most things worth trying, going to the well isn't as easy as it sounds. But my guest storytellers draw from their wells pretty effortlessly. Best thing about these guys is that they're also very dear friends, Paul Topekian and Michael Winters. Good morning, guys.
How you doing? Good
morning, Hank.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. And it really is a pleasure. You know, sometimes I say it's a pleasure. And do I really mean it? Yeah, most of the time. But I really do mean it with you guys. And we are recording this on Saturday morning. So I hope you watched the cartoons, had your Pop-Tarts, and are ready to go, right?
Yep.
Have you ever eaten a Pop-Tart, Paul? Have you got a favorite flavor?
I lived on cinnamon sugar without the frosting.
That's my favorite. Michael, have you have a favorite one? You're not
close. I think the strawberry jam, but that was probably 45 years ago, last time I had one.
If you're going to eat a strawberry jam Pop-Tart, as I'm sure Paul will agree because he's nodding his head too, don't eat a Pop-Tart. Have some toast or a bagel, right?
Yep.
Well, that's been about 45 years since I've last had a Pop-Tart. So,
You need to get out a little bit more. I met both of you guys at the Moth and Warehouse Live. Actually, my intern did, and that was the start of what we now call the Storytelling Mafia. Thanks to Paul, really. It's a spot-on label because I would turn to a team member, you know, next to me at the Moth, and I'd listen to a story. And if we liked it, I would nudge him and I'd say, you know, go get him. Give him a card. Make him an offer he can't refuse. Listeners, that was from The Godfather for those of you who don't get out much or don't have running water. But Paul, how did you come up with the term storytelling mafia? You really own it.
It seemed like a family, and it really does seem like a family, and maybe a cross between also the usual suspects, because if there's a story being told, you know, one of that group is usually at the scene of the crime. So it seemed right.
I love it. And your first storyteller, your first story isn't really really that devious from, it doesn't really deviate much from that concept because your first story is called Bruce Becomes an Action Figure. And I heard it. This was the last story that you told at the Moth. Tell us a story, then we'll talk about it.
Well, it starts out like most of us did. I started as a child. My birthday was a big deal, not just for me, but for my mom. I was born on the 6th of November, but she had gone into labor on the 4th. And needless to say, I think I was quite comfortable where I was and didn't want to come out. But ultimately, I was born, and it was a big deal because I am first generation in this country. And, you know, being that firstborn male child, that was a big deal. And things were great. I lived in a house with four generations. I was worshipped almost until my parents won a cruise at St. Anthony's Catholic Church. And 9 months later, my little brother Bruce came along. He was a pain in the ass, to say the least, when he was growing up. He really wasn't very fun. We couldn't play with him. He wouldn't play with us. He was always taking my action figures and breaking them or putting them someplace I couldn't find. And it really wasn't until I was probably about 10 that I realized I didn't need to play with action figures. I just could use Bruce because he could do everything those action figures could do even better. Now, this is, you know, I'm dating myself a bit. This is, you know, back in the 60s. And we were big Batman and Robin fans. You know, we watched I Spy. People were always getting caught and tied up. And my buddy Reggie and I realized that a lot of these things that they were doing, tying people up, well, they really couldn't do that. And so we wanted to challenge that. And we used Bruce. We would watch a Batman episode, see how they had tied Robin up and say, eh, Bruce can get out of that. And so we take Bruce out and we tie him to a tree and see if he could get out of it. And of course, he ultimately could. We tied him to rocks. We hog tied him one time in a way that if he did move the wrong way, he was probably going to strangle himself. But Bruce was pretty smart. He got out of it. The kids in the neighborhood knew we were doing this. And it's not like they told on us. It was more that they told their parents. And their parents told my parents, and that was when my father came along and said, you know, quit tying Bruce up to trees. And it was like, okay, I won't do that anymore. So Reggie and I hatched another scheme. This one kind of tied in another show that was popular at the time, which was, I'm losing my track of my memory on this one, but it involved Candid Camera. So, you know, the premise of that show is they have people out that are just going around photographing people in surprise settings. And what we decided to do, given that we did live in a very Catholic neighborhood, we were going to do a mock crucifixion of Bruce on the telephone pole outside our house and record the response of drivers going by with our little Instamatic camera. So we got a garbage can, tipped it up, put it up there, tied Bruce onto it. Mrs. Chufo, who lived next door, saw what we were doing and came out, and needless to say, we were not able to fulfill our task. My father got really, really upset and decided that, you know, just don't tie Bruce up to anything. Now, there's a flaw with that kind of parental guidance because it's very specific. And the next thing we did with Bruce sort of caused my father to up his game. Yonkers, where I lived, is very hilly. It's as almost as hilly as San Francisco. And there was a very steep hill outside of our house, ran down, probably dropped off about 100 feet in like 9 houses. So pretty steep. We decided we were going to see if we could roll Bruce down the street in a shopping cart. And the idea was to see how far he could go and whether or not he could actually guide the shopping cart by shifting his weight as he was sitting in it. Now, we rolled the shopping cart ourselves a couple of times and knew that it was going to go to the left a bit. And so we positioned Bruce on the right side of the road, taking into account the fact that it was going to go left. And we launched him. And, you know, shopping carts in the 60s and shopping carts today are not very different. The wheels on those things don't roll very well. The front wheels wobble like crazy. Then the center of gravity is really, really bad. And Bruce was holding on for dear life, ducked down in the cart, gaining speed when the front two wheels just flipped and the cart went over. And there was this thud, smack sound that just was terrible, followed by this howl, which was emanating from him as his head sort of slid on the pavement inside the shopping cart. Ran down, got Bruce out, brought Bruce home, blood all over the place. My mother was yelling at us, you know, don't get it on the rug. We went off to the hospital, and Bruce got sewn back together. My father, as I said, upped his game on parental advice. And instead of telling us not to roll Bruce down the street in a shopping cart again, he said, look, just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should. And that was really good advice that I don't think either Bruce or I took to heart really for probably the next 10 to 15 years. But the jump ahead on this is my brother, the action figure, became a crazy mountain climbing action figure and climbed all of the mountains, like the tallest peak in every continent, with the exception of Everest. Then it was 2.5 years ago when he was on Everest at about 21 or 22,000 feet, where he all of a sudden developed this really, really nasty cough. And, you know, mountain climbing is a serious endeavor. And getting to that height had taken 3 weeks. And he really, really wanted to summit that mountain. And he had to make a decision. He probably could go on and do it. But if he did, it could be dicey. And I think my brother at that point in time finally took my father's advice. He decided he was not going up the mountain. He turned around and came down. And I just got to say that, you know, I'm glad he's still my brother. I'm glad he's no longer climbing mountains. And he has always been in my heart the best action figure I've ever had.
Thank you, Paul. I love that story for a lot of reasons. And I told you that after you were kind enough to send me that story. And I, you know, it resonates with me for so many reasons. I was raised in a home with three generations rather than four. I obviously, you and I are just about the same age, although you're a little bit younger, but then again, nobody is older than me. So, you know, let's forget about that one. And by the way, you know, forgetting a little bit, nobody who was grown up in the 60s watching the shows that you list can possibly remember things. We're not supposed to. We're really old people, right? But, yep. You know, I would also add Man from U.N.C.L.E., Mission Impossible, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, one of the things that I'm always impressed by in your stories, you cover a lot of ground in your stories. You really dance between this fine line of a very focused story, but you cover a lot of ground. You really do. You know, you have a way of going from growing up in the 60s to your brother climbing Mount Everest and bringing it back again. That's not an easy thing to do. So in terms of going to the well, you give me an opportunity to dig deep and find things that really resonate with me and love your story even more. I know there are a lot of lessons to stories, a lot of parables. If you had to come up with one, just one that we need to walk away with, what would that be?
Well, I don't know if it's from that story, but it's from a story I'll tell later. And I think it's that there's wisdom that comes to us in ways that we don't realize. And a lot of times to me, the stories, at least some of the stories I tell, I think are getting at that point.
Okay. So the older we get, the wiser we get, and we convey that in our stories.
Or just the more experiences we've had, and maybe we realize our foolishness, which, you know,
right.
Foolishness, if you can get on top of it, can kind of lead you to wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. Great point. Great equation. Absolutely right. Paul, you're retired, but you work for Exxon, right? Well, what did you do for them?
As my wife would say, I was a businessman. I had so many, jobs with them. It was crazy. I'm an undergrad sociologist with an MBA. I should have never hired into an engineering company. At the end, I was running service centers all over the globe, and it was great. But the best thing about it was I was able to retire about 10 years ago. So that's the good news.
Beautiful. Yeah. Well, we'll just call you professionally ambidextrous, sure, but your wife can call you a businessman. But, you know, there's a reason I'm asking you this, because continuing to learn about what you folks do for a living, Dr. Michael Winters, who was on the board of the Houston Storytellers Guild, among other things, is about to reveal his livelihood in this story. So, Paul, thank you for that segue. Now, I don't want to give away much about your story, Michael, but I like to title it Oxymoron. Maybe the emphasis on moron. I don't know. Let's hear your story.
My first marriage was brief. Very brief. 9 weeks after we got married, she moved out. Now, this was, of course, incredibly painful because I loved her. But perhaps even more than pain, I experienced embarrassment. You see, 1 week before we had gotten married, I had graduated with a PhD in psychology. Yes, I am a psychotherapist and a marriage counselor, and my own marriage had fallen apart before it even launched. It was so devastating to me. Everything that I thought I knew was questioned. Everything about the world, everything about myself. So you might understand that I became a little skittish about dating, about connecting deeply, about the whole concept of commitment. For a few years, I kind of tentatively dated, and then I met Kelly. And Kelly, you know, the night after our first date, my jaw ached because we had been smiling so much. We had a great time. We would have these deep intellectual conversations. We would laugh a lot. She helped me redecorate my house. We had a great 3 months. And she'd helped me decorate my house. We had one more thing to get, and we were planning a party because the house looked great. So we had one thing to get. It was a bookcase with an unpronounceable name at IKEA, and we decided to go get it. So I remember getting in the car. We were driving south on Studewood, about to turn west on I-10. We're having this conversation about the party. Now, we knew the date of the party. It was February 2nd. So, of course, the theme was going to be Groundhog Day. But we were kind of discussing, well, what could make this even more compelling? What could make it, you know, a reason that people would definitely come to the party more than Groundhog Day? And so without thinking at all, I just casually said, well, maybe we could have an engagement party. And Kelly, who was driving, stopped the car in the middle of the road, turned to me with this huge grin and this twinkle in her eye. And she said, are you asking what I think you're asking? And then time started going slowly, very slowly. But my mind was going really fast because I was thinking, oh my gosh, did I just say what I think I said? And then I started doing the mental math. First marriage was together we dated for a year, and then we were together for 9 weeks. This is like 3 months, this is like 2.5 weeks, and she'll be gone. And then I was like, okay, how can I unsend? How can I unsay what I just said? But it was too late. I could not do that. So I looked at her and I swallowed hard. Very hard. And I said, I guess so. So we kissed there in the middle of the road until somebody started honking behind us. And we went on and we went to IKEA, and we got not only the bookcase with an unpronounceable name, but we also got several dozen champagne flutes, which we would need for our groundhog engagement party. On the way back, we stopped at Little Papacito's restaurant, had dinner. And near the end of dinner, we told our waitstaff, we just got engaged. And they comped our dessert. So for the next 3 months, every time we went out, we told the waitstaff, we just got engaged. Didn't work as well after that first night. You know, this has been over 26 years now. And I still wonder what prompted me to accidentally propose, and probably the least romantic proposal in the history of the world. But now when I look across the room and I see Kelly there, I just recognize, you know, we are still together and we are still in love, very much in love.
And we're very happy for you. Thank you. I love that story. You know,
that is really good.
But when did you first give yourself permission to tell this story?
That's hard because it's you know, the first marriage was so short, but probably, you know, 10 or 15 years into mm-hmm. the marriage with Kelly, that just kind of became, it's like, I'm so glad, you know, that mm-hmm. I didn't stay in that relationship with somebody that really didn't like me.
Right.
To find somebody that really did, and to be able to have that contrast, to be able to know what it's like to be in a relationship with somebody that doesn't love you, and then to find somebody that does.
Yeah, well, I think the story is a great example of what Dolly Parton once said: if you want the rainbow, you got to put up with the rain. I mean, you put up with a lot.
Yep.
Now let's do another story. This one I like to call perspective.
So you remember Kelly? We're married now, and she had the worst sinus infection that I've ever heard of. She was hospitalized for it, and I was driving to go get her favorite Turkish food, take it out, bring it back to the hospital to her. So I was frustrated. I was concerned about her, but I was calm as I was driving, and I noticed as I was driving that there was a van stopped at a stop sign, but then as I was driving through the intersection, it moved forward. And then I heard a bam, and the back of my Prius started moving and fishtailing. I recognized my car had been hit. So I just kind of coasted over to the curb, and I was really ticked off and forgetting for a moment that we live in Texas where you can legally carry a gun. I jumped out of the car and said, "What's wrong with you? You hit my car." And the driver just kind of like said, "Well, I stopped." I said, But you hit me. I was really confused about all this, but I was still really, really angry. And then I kind of went into kind of a haze, knowing, okay, what do you got to do? I went and got my, called 911, got my insurance information, went over, got her insurance information. She parked next to this little grassy area. And as I was stepping back from looking at her insurance information, I recognize this was a really bad day. Wife in the hospital, just been in an auto accident, and I smelled something really foul. I had just stepped in dog poop. Now my energy, you know, for some reason I thought, okay, this person is my opponent. I have to, you know, she hit me. It was clear, you know, I did not have a stop sign. I was driving under the speed limit. She was at fault. It wasn't my fault. I couldn't do anything that would look suspicious or possibly indicate that there was any guilt on my end. So I was really in that energy and really kind of, you know, just really holding that anger. And we were waiting for the police to come, and I just kind of walked off. And I started thinking, though, you know, this was a relatively minor accident. Both our cars were still drivable. Nobody was hurt. But I started thinking about another accident where a student of mine, she was just 28 years old, Kristen, who had taken a class that I offer for advanced counselors. She wasn't an advanced counselor. She was still in school, but she found this and said, "I want to take this class." She said, "Is there a student discount?" Well, there wasn't. So she found the way to pay the money. And she drove 2 hours each way every time that class met. This wasn't her curriculum. This was out of her time. And Kristen was so full of life. When I first heard that she'd been in an accident and died, I was overwhelmed. I could not believe it because she was so full of life. You know, Kristen had this really mature, optimistic way of being. In this class that I taught, we tackled these really difficult concepts like genocide. And she was the youngest person in class by several years, but she was as mature and able to engage those concepts with as much grace as anybody. You know, her colleagues in the program that she was working in kind of had this idea of psychology as being almost like this mental plumbing. That's kind of the way they approached it. But Kristen saw her mission as a sacred act because every individual was unique. When I looked at Kristen, I thought of her as what I hoped the future of psychology would be. But then she was gone, and I realized I would need to take that challenge on myself. Well, my perspective softened. I went back to the other driver, Anita, and asked how she was doing. She said she was really kind of shaken because she'd been in another accident before and had been almost hurt. But, you know, I started talking with her and she started to seem like she calmed down. She told me that her son was born in the hospital that we were just yards away from 25 years before. I told her about my wife in a hospital several miles away and her suffering. And we started to just make a connection. She said she was really worried because it was a company van and she was afraid that she would get fired. Well, her boss showed up well before the police did. And I told them, I hope that she wouldn't be penalized for making a mistake that anybody could have made. Now, Anita, I could kind of tell. Now, I'm not very religious, but I could tell that she was. And so I told her, you know, I'm not sure why God has brought us together today. And I wish it was under different circumstances, but I'm glad to have met you. Now, eventually, you know, the police came, got reports, got to the Turkish restaurant. They made me fresh food. Kelly recovered. But I learned several things that day. First, connect with other human beings. Second, no matter what it is that you're feeling, anger, hurt, pain, it will ease with time. And third, you can scrape dog poop off of your shoe. It just amazes me when I think about that, how quickly things change for me when I was able to shift perspective. Because sometimes when cars and worlds collide, a life is lost. But sometimes a new connection can be made.
Beautiful. And I wanted you to tell the story on purpose. I asked you to do it. I asked you guys to tell certain stories intentionally for a lot of good reasons. And Michael, this is one that really brings the true you out as a therapist, as a human being, and you know, how they fuse, because that isn't easy all the time. Stories about connection are sometimes the most difficult because they're ambiguous and sometimes trite. And this one is so rich and it's so, so very real. I asked Paul last time about the messages, and I'm not going to ask you the question because you just offered us the reasons why you told the story and the sorts of things that we need to learn from it. But if there's one word that comes to mind that would characterize this young woman, this student of yours, just one word, what would it be?
Potential.
Okay. Beautiful. Paul, you know, I've heard your next story and I can't really get it out of my mind. There's no hyperbole here. This is one of my five favorite stories that you're about to tell. And that's a big deal because not only have I heard stories all of my life by my family, but by thousands of students and thousands of others. So we're not talking about identifying this as one of my favorite out of the 10 or 20 that I've heard. We're talking thousands. And it's called The Right Place at the Right Time. Let's enjoy this one.
So Exxon was going through a cost-cutting phase. I did a lot of travel, and one of the ways that they had decided they would cut cost would be to have us fly on connecting flights instead of direct flights when we were traveling in the U.S. And as a result, I was traveling from Washington, D.C. down to Houston, but I was routed through Charlotte. And I had never been to Charlotte before, and my plane was one of those little Embraer 155s. It's got three seats across. It's really small. They're nice, but they're small. And I was lucky because I was in the very front seat. We were delayed. I had a tight connection. The stewardess knew that I was a frequent flyer with this super frequent flyer status. And she was doing the best she could to take good care of me, which basically was over serving me Diet Coke for probably about 3 hours. The bathroom on the plane was all the way at the back. And so when we landed in Charlotte, I needed to use the restroom really, really badly. If you travel a lot, you know how your favorite airports are laid out. I didn't know Charlotte at all. I came off the plane. I'm looking for restrooms. And they had those little people figurines, you know, the man and the, you know, male and the female. And so I made a beeline for the restroom. And I had to go really bad. So I just in the restroom and had my bag with me, closed the stall door. And there's this, I think all of us have experienced this at some point in time where you're in such pain, in my case, because I really needed to pee, that once you start to urinate, that pain almost turns to pleasure. And I thought I was alone in the restroom, and I must have made a sound that went something like, oh. And right after I did that, I heard somebody two stalls away go, well, that was impressive. And my brain was like, okay, I'm having a conversation with somebody in the bathroom. They're using the word impressive. That's not a good word to be using in a bathroom with a stranger. And then on the other side of me, there was this giggling. And I was realizing as I was listening that these were women. And I'm thinking, what in the hell are they doing in the men's room? And then as I, you know, kind of my brain became engaged since my bladder had stopped, I started recognizing things. There were no urinals. This bathroom smelled really, really well. And then I realized, oh my God, I am in the women's room. And so at that point, we started discussing what the exit strategy would be. I wanted to get out of the bathroom as soon as I could. I didn't want them to come out. It would be awkward, blah, blah, blah. It's best if we're just ships passing in the night. And so they agreed they would wait until they heard the door close. And I would book out the door. Working for Exxon, I had been trained to always worry about what's the worst thing that could happen. And as I was making a beeline to go out the door, I started thinking about, whoa, wait a second. I'm going to bust out of this women's room into the concourse. What's the worst that could happen? There's going to be a bunch of Girl Scouts on some little Girl Scout trip coming right at me. And I almost panicked and went back, but I didn't. Went out the door and there was nobody there, thank God, except this one guy who's looking at me like, you just came out of the women's room. And I was like, well, it's really quite nice. It smells really good in there. And he just stared at me, and this, I shouldn't have stopped because it gave time for the woman who had been in the stall, who was very impressed, to walk out behind me and say, well, you know, when you gotta go, you gotta go. Then I said, yep, and I think I'd better go also. And I made my way down the terminal to my gate and caught the plane. And, you know, I've often heard, you know, the saying that it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. But this is one of those situations where really, and this is the title of the story, you really need to be in the right place at the right time if it's a public restroom.
Okay, now let me tell you why I love this story. Michael, you're not in on this either. Paul knows. Our listeners, I think, will enjoy this as they're driving home, right? I'm ready to leave, going somewhere. I'm an Intercontinental. I quickly walk into a restroom. I realize it's the ladies' room I just walked into. I start laughing. And I say, Paul. You can imagine the responses I get from the ladies in there. He's laughing, yelling, Paul. And that was it. I texted you right away to let you know, thank you very much for your story. You embarrassed the hell out of me. This is Hank Rubicek, and you are enjoying my guest storytellers, Paul Topekian and Dr. Michael Winters on So What's Your Story? Only on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM, and right here in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. We are going to the well tonight, and I'm going to say a little bit more about that in just a moment. But first, given the fact that it's a new year, one of the best things you can do is to learn to tell stories. Now, I was watching the film Big Fish the other day, and it reminded me of what all of us need to know, that our life is our story, and our story is our life. And you know what? Learning to tell stories is easier than you think in Houston, because this town really is a storyteller's dream. Our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, is a terrific place to gather a few skills in telling stories. They meet virtually the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. So please visit their website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for information about upcoming events. Also, please visit us on So What's Your Story at facebook.com/SoWhat'sYourStory and let us know if you have guests that we should consider, or text me at 832-277-1581. I'm Hank, and that's me, so you're dialing the right number. The Moth at Warehouse Live is back in full gear the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy some startling, moving, and everything in between narratives, and meet some of the greatest people around. Okay, now let's go to the well for a moment with this recollection. Okay, guys, Paul, Michael, think of a memorable moment in grade school. Think of the characters involved, the teacher, maybe a friend, maybe there's a bully. Think about what you see and smell and touch. I want you to take about 45 seconds to a minute at the most and describe it. Don't worry about putting it in story form, but describe it. I'll give you about 30 seconds to think about that. Do, 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 do. Do, 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 do. Okay, now, Paul, let's start with you. Tell us what you're describing. Describe that moment.
So it's sort of the pandemonium of classes when kids are getting in and they're putting all their stuff under their desks, and that smell would be, I mean, I don't know if you guys remember this, but the janitors used to have this, it was like a waxy sawdust, and it had a chemical smell to it. Although I'm not sure. It's just that sort of walking into the classroom smell. Mm-hmm. That's what I remember. My grade school was a PS22 in Yonkers, and it was just a classic old school right. building.
Now, what I want our listeners to know is that this is a great way to learn a story, obviously, right? And your stories, the ones that you're telling tonight, have come from a well. You may not know that, but all the sensory stimuli is there. So, for example, it was pandemonium. It was in the fifth grade, and we put this together in story form. And even though, again, it sounds a little bit easier than it really is, this is a great way to build the story. And most importantly, to find description. Description is a strange word, because we sometimes think of description as things like I was scared, but instead it's my heart was in my throat and then it landed in my stomach and stayed there. This kind of an exercise
gets us there. Michael, what's your description?
Well, it's interesting. It's the fifth grade, but a little different situation. My math teacher, Ms. Holt, so this wasn't the homeroom teacher, Ms. Holt asked me to stay after school to talk about my math test. And we didn't really talk about math. She just was interested in me. She was asking me questions about me. And Ms. Holt, now she was probably 27, 28, you know, young woman, attractive. I remember, you know, I could smell like the chalk, but there was also not really perfume, but just a fresh, you know, beautiful woman smell for, you know, what a fifth grade boy could imagine. Right. And it was just amazing to me that she was interested in me, not just in my, you know, careless math mistakes.
But she wasn't just interested in your mind.
She was interested in me as a human being. And it's like, I knew like my parents had to be interested. My homeroom teacher sort of had to be interested. She didn't have to be interested.
Right. How old were you?
I was just there to, so fifth grade would be 11, something like that. 10, 11. Yeah.
11. What an age. And she was roughly how old?
She was probably 27, 28.
All right. So you are a real believer in powerful openings, right? I know you are. I know you are. And the first thing that came to my mind is this. And again, I want our listeners to know what this exercise is about, a way of really crafting a story. So I'm thinking, I was 11 and she was 27, but I knew she loved me and I knew she wanted me. Now you guys, and I appreciate this. I know this is a real quick exercise and I appreciate you guys are great at doing this. You're good eggs for doing this, and I appreciate it. But you know, it's really important to be able to dig deep, capture the moment, embrace the image, delivery the memory vividly, descriptively, like you own it, because you do. We want listeners to know that they own their stories. They own their own well. Great. I appreciate you guys doing that. Now, Paul, your next story is going to resonate with any boomer. Called the Science Project, plain and simple.
Absolutely. And science projects go on. I mean, they still do them. So you don't have to be a boomer. I have to say, I had a crush on Joni Nicoletti in my fifth grade class. And Joni Nicoletti didn't know who I mean, she knew who I was because we had to stand in size order before we went into class. She was the shortest person in the class, and I was the second shortest person in the class. So she knew me, but I was not on her radar screen as anybody of interest. And when Ms. Salafiandra said, you know, it's time for science fair, and she started writing these words, interactive, tactile, multidimensional, dynamic, you know, I was like, okay, this is my shot. I can do this. And as you guys may know, I'm a big Mr. Wizard fan. And so science was my thing. So what I did, and it decided I was going to go with tried and true, but I was going to step it up a notch. So I went with the baking soda and vinegar volcano, which seems pretty lame, if you will, for fifth grade science project class. But my intent was to kind of step it up by working on coloring the foam coming out. I spent a lot of time working on how much dye and what kind of dye and how to mix it, whether it should be in the baking soda or whether it should be in the vinegar. And I had it down. I could make red lava really, really good. My dad, who was a jeweler, was also into model railroads, and he helped me build. I mean, it was the most realistic 18-inch volcano you've ever seen in your life. There was trees and roads. There were two villages. One of them is going to get wiped out when the lava came down. I mean, it was really going to be very, very stunning. And so I brought my project in. My seatmate, Orla Gaffney at the time, had decided she was going to go with more of a nature theme. And I don't know about what your guys' elementary school setup was, but we had, you know, there were probably about 25 or 30 kids, and we were in two desks together, you know, and like three seats, you know, two seats, two seats, two seats, and then several rows going back. So Orly had brought in praying mantis nests from her backyard, and she had a poster board, and she had all this information about praying mantises. She had one that was dead that was pinned up on it, and she had all these really interesting facts about praying mantises. Stuff that I didn't know. You know, the nests hold between 500 to 800 babies. They're related, and I didn't know this, they're related to termites and cockroaches, and that the females practice cannibalistic copulation, which for a fifth grader was like, well, I don't know what that is, until somebody whispered, they eat the head when the when they're having sex. And it was like, oh my God. Anyhow, she did her presentation. It was very, very impressive. I did mine, and you know, I had my vinegar, had everything ready to go, and I put the vinegar in, and nothing happened. Zero. And I put more vinegar in, and nothing happened. And I stirred around with a straw to see if something was blocking it, and poured more vinegar in, and nothing happened. And it was just totally demoralizing. And, you know, I went home at the end of the day. You know, if Joni Nicoletti was going to notice me, she was going to notice me, because I really was a dud, as was my volcano. When I got home, I figured out what had gone wrong. I had, in my haste that morning, grabbed apple juice, not apple cider vinegar. And when you put baking soda and apple juice together, nothing happens. So, you know, okay, I can redeem this, because my volcano was really pretty damn good. So Monday morning, I go in and I've got my vinegar and all set to go, and never got the opportunity. We got in the class, we're all getting settled, and orderly opened her desk, and the three nests of praying mantises that she had stored in her little desk had apparently hatched over the weekend. And these are these desks where, you know, you open the top up to get your books out and you put it back down. She opened that nest up, and praying mantises were going left and right and up and down and all. I mean, there probably were like 1,000 of them. And so we reacted, you know, as fifth grade boys would. You know, we grabbed rulers and started running around the classroom trying to smack them and kill them and whatnot. And then orderly's yelling at us because she's got more information about praying mantises. You can't kill them. They're endangered. There's a $10 fine. And it's just pure pandemonium. Everybody's going nuts. Mrs. LaFiandra got on the intercom and she called for help. And help was Joe, the custodian, who came up, walked in the door, kind of appraised the situation. Kids running all over the place, praying mantises on everything, in girls' hair. And he said, everybody shut up. Sit in your desks. I'm going to open the windows. They're going to fly out. And that is exactly what he did. And that is exactly what happened. And, you know, the takeaway from me on that one was, I was talking about wisdom. You know, to me, that was a good example of practical wisdom. I mean, he knew what to do. And he knew how to fix the situation. And it was also one of those situations where you realize, you know, you don't think very much of the janitor, but at the end of the day, he's really the one that sort of ran our school and saved our lives, at least from the praying mantises.
I love this, you know, and the reason why I say boomers resonate is because although science projects are obviously conducted now, I know that they were required. They were required at one point. And they were very specifically required. When I was in the seventh grade, you know, we had to do an insect collection. Everybody had to do an insect collection. Well, I'm asthmatic. So, you know, I'm a seventh grader charged with building an insect collection. So armed with my Primatene Mist, which I put in my t-shirt sleeve, you know, looking cool. I go out in the woods trying to catch insects. Doesn't work. I figured I'm going to go buy one. So I go to my hobby shop. I buy one. And I looked in the back and I said, it said Yale. And I said, well, this is a definite A. So I buy this insect collection, give it to Mr. Johns, our seventh grade teacher, gives it back to me, a C minus. I said, Mr. Johns, a C minus? Really? He says, look, I know you didn't do this, but there must be a reason. So I didn't want to fail you, but you didn't do this. That's why I gave you a C minus. I said, but Mr. Johns, this one was done at Yale University. He said, it's Yale Hobby Shop. Yeah. in the meantime, talk about wisdom and also stupidity. Now, Michael, I know that you got several stories about your father, and the smokehouse is beautifully focused, the story about the smokehouse, because it gives a lot of depth and a lot of breadth, right? And this is the one that's coming up right now. And I'm just going to let you tell the story, and then we'll make a few comments about it.
Okay. When my parents got together, my mom said she wanted 5 kids, and my dad wanted 4. So they had 5, and then they had 4, but they could not stop there because, see, I was the 9th child born, and 10 minutes later, my twin sister was born. So that was number 10. So they kept going until they had 14 kids altogether. Now, when you have a family of 16, you need a lot of food. And my parents learned how to do that very economically. My mom was the primary food maker, and she could whip up 8 gallons of chili, you know, really quickly. And that would just sit on the stove and serve everybody. She was the everyday food maker. But on the weekends, see, this was, I think, their contract. My mom would take all the kids to church, and my dad would stay home and make breakfast. And he made wonderful breakfasts. And his specialty was ham and biscuits. I'm going to tell you about the biscuits in a minute, but I want to kind of talk about ham first, because if barbecue is the Texas state food or nation of Texas food, country ham would be for Tennessee the at least state food. And my grandfather had multiple grand champion country hams at the state fair. This was something he was really good at. And my dad wanted to follow in his footsteps. When my grandfather died, my dad kept that ham business going. Now, they'd shipped hams to the Philippines. They had customers all over the world. And my dad tried to keep that up, but he recognized with his day job, he could not keep that business up. So he closed down the commercial smokehouse, but he wanted to keep the tradition going. So one year, he decides to convert a corner of our basement into a curing room and smokehouse. Now, I don't know what the conversations between my parents were when my dad said, yeah, I want to, you know, just light a fire for 2.5 weeks in the basement underneath this house where 16 people live. But we did it. So we got this really thick black plastic and stapled it to the ceiling so everything would stay contained in that smokehouse. And the first day, it worked. Now, to smoke hams, you need to smoke them for about 2.5 weeks. So day one was fine. Day two, in the back of the house, there was just this very light, faint, lovely hickory smoke smell. By day three, the whole house smelled of smoke and did for months after the fire was put out. So we never did have a smokehouse in the basement after that, but our family did have at least a couple of years of delicious country ham to have after that.
All right. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There's a biscuit piece to this because that's really my dad's piece.
I was happy that your family didn't starve to death because you're like a contemporary Waltons.
Didn't starve to death and didn't go up in flames either.
No. Your father was a unique guy. Give us 3 adjectives that you would associate with your dad.
Well, I want to take it another level. I want to talk about him. I'm going to give 3 in one phrase.
Okay.
Quiet, gentle wisdom.
Nice.
That's what I think of with my dad.
Beautiful. You know, both of you gentlemen appreciate what extraordinary storytellers have always understood. You can't do anything about the length of your life, but stories can help you do something about its width and its depth. You are tuned into So What's Your Story, only on Houston's community station, KPFT. This is a tough question, guys, and I asked you to think about it before before the show, but you've all heard lots of stories, lots of personal stories. If you had to think of one or two and give us maybe just no more than like a 30-second reason for why you like these stories, tell us, give our listeners a sense of what you really appreciate and what makes an impact for you in a story. Paul, what's one or two stories that you remember that really made an impact?
Well, I can't remember the stories, but I can tell you attributes of stories. The story that Michael was just telling as an example, being able to visualize the place and what's happening, and with that one, being able to smell it, to me, it's those kinds of story attributes that make a story a good story. And there has to be more to it. There's got to be something that's going on and they lead someplace and whatnot. But I really think that makes a huge, huge difference for me when I'm listening.
And if I may, you're really punctuating the power of going to the well, because you're talking about it really being descriptive enough where you see the image, you smell, you taste, you can actually get that verbal picture in your mind. Very good. Michael, what about you? Story come to mind?
Well, I think I want to follow Paul's trend here and say what happens for me with a story. For my personal stories, the good stories are the ones where, you know, I was unaware when it happened of the value of what was happening or how it turned out. Maybe it felt like a tragedy at the moment, but later, oh man, I'm glad I'm not married to that woman anymore. You know, with my dad, you know, it was just like really not being aware of how powerful, of how grateful I was to him and, you know, that I never gave him that gratitude. So it's kind of just the story resonates as, wow, there was a lot going on that I didn't recognize in that moment. So it's just trying to be more in touch with what's happening in those important moments in our lives.
Yeah. Very reflective. Beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you, Michael Winters and Paul Topekian, for your signature style and for your generosity of heart. You know, this show goes, it always goes so quickly, much too quickly for me. And the power of story never ceases to amaze me, especially when guys like you are telling them. Thank you both. Don't you dare move, which won't be difficult because most of you are stuck in traffic right about now anyway, because Charles Hightower's R&B Gold is up next with a cool mix of soul. Make Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1, a part of every day. And while you're driving home or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 5 for So What's Your Story? You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubichek, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to never forget that even if a story doesn't end happily, it doesn't mean you can't live happily ever after. Peace.
This is Susan, your host of Border Radio on Houston's community station, KPFT. Join us Saturday afternoons from 4 to 6 for Border Radio right after Deadbeat. We'll feature some of your favorite independent artists and songs from new artists on the rise. We'll spotlight concerts for the week to come, from in-person shows in our area to live stream events you can enjoy right from home. And Border Radio will keep bringing you the great on-air interviews you've come to expect from KPFT. Mark your calendar for Border Radio, Saturday afternoons from 4 to 6 on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM, FM HD1, and kpft.org.
Pacifico Radio is doing what it does best.
And the rich white companies are jumping the line so they can get access to the vaccine.
Covering the global pandemic.
I think people need to wake up and recognize that this is a fight against slavery.
The working class movement against racism and imperialism.
If we have a First Amendment, it needs to extend from government to how these big tech companies are basically run by proxy in the public sphere.
And holding politicians and corporate media accountable to the people. This and much more on COVID, race, and democracy. Tuesdays at 8 a.m. on KPFT.
You're listening Houston. To...